You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
This July, the United States of America will celebrate 250 years since the Declaration of Independence, when the original 13 colonies broke away from the British Empire under King George III. Recently, however, millions of Americans have taken to the streets to voice their disapproval of a man they see as a new monarchical figure, President Donald J. Trump. The original No Kings protests were held on the 14th of June last year to coincide with Donald Trump's birthday military parade. The most recent round of demonstrations occurred last weekend and drew an estimated 8 million people, united by the belief that the president must respect the boundaries of his office. This morning I spoke to Jennifer Frost, Professor of History at the University of Auckland and Chairperson of the New Zealand Chapter of Democrats Abroad, about the significance of these demonstrations in the context of American history. President Donald Trump certainly seems to enjoy playing into this association with monarchy. Last year, he tweeted a quote attributed to Emperor Napoleon, "He who saves his country does not violate any law." Around that same time, he tweeted, "Long live the king," in celebration of his administration's successful effort to halt congestion pricing tolls in New York City. He also seems to be a massive admirer of the British royal family, reveling in every invitation he gets to meet the king. So do you think that Trump's interest in monarchy is little more than a superficial love of glamorous gilded palaces, or do you believe he actually has aspirations to overturn the American system of government and rule as something closer to a monarch?
Yes, I think both. He definitely likes all the trappings of monarchy, and as we have seen with the White House and even Washington, D.C., how he's been remaking the architecture and the decorations, you know, more and more gilt, more and more gold, you know, more and more fancy trappings. And so he certainly loves that, and he loves the motorcades, and he loves all the attention, et cetera. But at the same time, he and the people behind him believe in a legal theory within the United States about what's called the unitary executive. And it really is concentrating even more power in the hands of the executive branch in the White House. And on top of that, the Supreme Court in 2024 gave Trump almost total immunity for anything he does in office, which is very king-like. In fact, it's more power than King Charles has, in Great Britain.
So is this unitary executive theory, does it have an actual constitutional foundation?
No, we would say no. So legal critics would say, no, it doesn't. And the whole premise of the U.S. Constitution was to balance power among the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branch. And in fact, not to have so much power, monarchical power in the hands of the executive. And again, the United States or the colonies fought a revolution against a king and monarchy and sought to establish a republic in which the people have sovereignty, have the authority and govern to rule. So the entire premise for us as historians and for most legal scholars would be absolutely the unitary executive theory is bunk. But there are legal scholars who are conservative who are pushing this, and there are members of the Supreme Court who push this, and certainly there are people in the current Trump regime who support this.
While the No Kings protests were happening in the States, parallel protests were also held in up to 20 foreign countries as a show of solidarity. However, in constitutional monarchies like the United Kingdom and Canada, the slogan had to be changed from No Kings to No Tyrants or No Dictators in order to avoid confusion. Obviously, we live in a country which technically still has a monarch, and the word king is not necessarily a dirty word to the same degree that it is in the States, where the opposition to monarchy is baked into the founding story of the nation. In 2026, as we approach the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence, how much does that founding revolutionary story still shape the way Americans think about their special, unique nation?
Yes, I think it really is still very important. And you're absolutely right about the, what do you call your protest? So we had our first protest in this vein in last weekend in Auckland, and we called it No Tyrants. And that was the decision of a group I'm part of called Democrats Abroad, which really focuses on getting out the vote from Americans living abroad. And obviously, these, you know, we're not going to have a no kings when King Charles is, you know, much preferred over Trump, I have to say, for most of us. And there's more limits on what Charles can do, obviously, with, you know, the parliament, et cetera. So, but I think it is the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution. And one of the really important things that's been happening, especially with the No Kings, No Tyrants protests, is taking back American patriotism, taking back the flag, taking back we the people, right? That has sort of been the really territory of the right for decades now. And one of the things that the, you know, kind of liberal left moderate has been really pushing is we are just as patriotic and believe in the ideals of the United States, and we need to reclaim the symbols, the language, the arguments of that era.
Yes, this is a very sensitive question, obviously, but do you think that maybe the liberal left in America, one of the reasons why they failed is that they have been scared about tapping into a kind of traditional American patriotism?
I think part of the problem for us, and actually I even feel this way teaching U.S. history, is, you know, we don't have a simple argument. So we have, let's be very critical of both the historical injustices of the United States, from slavery to land theft to genocide, and let's be honest and forthright about that. At the same time, can we appreciate the historic significance and celebrate the values of the ideals of the United States, you know, the best of what the United States stood for? So it's just a more challenging argument to make.
So going back to this comparison between 1776 and 2026, the Revolutionary War was obviously a very bloody affair, but one of the important features of the recent No Kings protests is their commitment to nonviolence. Indeed, the last round of protests has been called the largest nonviolent demonstration in U.S. history. As a historian, do you think that nonviolent protests have the potential to create real change? And if so, what would you say is the most recent comparable example in American history?
I think what's so important about nonviolence in this moment, as well as it was in the civil rights movement and other movements, is especially when you're going up against a violent regime, right, that's trying to achieve its aims through violence, to be giving a counterexample of seeking change, pursuing change through nonviolence, I think that's really powerful. And the other thing is the goal of these movements and protests is, you know, connecting people, and really people have been talking about the joy, and I know for us in Auckland, it was a joy to see people. People are bringing their signs, their costumes, the creativity, the humor. It all challenges the grim hostility of this authoritarian Trump regime and gives us a different vision of what our world could be.
Now, is there a point where things get so bad that it's time to bring out the guillotine?
Well, I know that, I mean, things are bad, right? War crimes are being committed. Crimes are being committed against people in detention. You know, people are losing their lives, you know, in the streets, you know, in the Caribbean. I mean, it is as grim and bleak as it could be. And yes, that is one of the things that people are talking about, is there tends to be in the United States this sort of forgive and forget, you know, let's move on. When Richard M. Nixon committed crimes, you know, he was pardoned by his successor, Gerald Ford. You know, Obama, when he came in 2009 after winning in 2008, you know, everybody thought he was going to close Guantanamo, and he was going to, you know, try members of the Bush administration for, you know, for war crimes. You know, none of that happened. Even the Biden administration didn't go strongly enough after Trump, I would say, and his ilk. And so that, a lot of people are calling for that. That can't be how it is, that we need some sort of truth and reconciliation process, that we really need to confront and expose and be transparent about all the crimes, all the corruption that's happening, if we're going to get someplace different. And I think one of the things that everybody's calling for is not just restoration of what came before Trump, but really a reconstruction. We can't just restore the democracy or the political system, the economic system that brought us to this place. That's not going to get us any place different, right? That's going to be just as fragile and uncertain as where we are now. And so there really has to be a much greater vision of where we're going and true reconstruction. And to get that started, this kind of truth and reconciliation process would be very important. I was just reading an article this morning about something like 12 or so of the January Sixers that had been convicted and were in jail for their crimes on January 6, 2021. You know, Trump pardoned them all the first day he was inaugurated, and 12 of them are already back in prison for absolutely horrific crimes, right? And the thing is, this regime with the pardons that have happened, all the corruption, it's like giving carte blanche to anybody who is a criminal. And, you know, really, of course, violating the rule of law and ignoring the rule of law. And that has to get reestablished somehow. It's going to take somebody in leadership and an administration in leadership and a party in leadership that is trying to make change. At the same time, you can't be so punitive that you just destroy everything in its wake. It's a more complicated task, right? Because the goal really is to bring everybody into some sort of coalition and move forward. Otherwise, we're really in trouble.
That was Professor Jennifer Frost from the University of Auckland.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.